everyone, I'm Colin Ellis, best-selling author, award-winning public speaker, and facilitator of global workplace culture change. And in this, the Culture Makers podcast, I get people managers from around the world to share actionable things that you can do too to create a great place to work. I hope you enjoy the show. Everybody, and welcome to another Culture Makers podcast with me, your host, Colin Ellis. And today on the podcast, I'm joined by Mark Hooper. Now, Mark is currently the Group CEO and Managing Director at Paragon Care. He's also a former Chief Financial Officer, Executive Director, and Chief Operating Officer for many different businesses in the pharmacy, consumer, and medical consumables business, with a fantastic track record of leadership and culture building stretching back almost 30 years. He was also the chair of the National Pharmaceutical Services Agency, the peak organization representing full-line pharmaceutical wholesalers in Australia for 5 years. He's been involved in mergers, acquisitions, fended off takeovers, transformations, and prides himself on creating great places to work. And he joins me now from Melbourne, Australia. Hello, Mark.
Morning, Colin. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Is that how your kids think of you, as, you know, having a fantastic track record of leadership and culture building?
No, they think of me as that old bloke that laughs like Muttley.
I always think that our kids find out our legacy when they meet people at our funeral. Oh, Dad did that. Oh, did he? Oh.
No, a much less glorious view of me from my children, I have to say.
I remember inviting my children to a speech that I did in New Zealand, and I was up on this huge stage. I don't know, it was about 500 people there with these massive screens. And I came off and my son said to me, he's like, "So you just get paid to walk up and down and talk then?" I was like, "Yeah, if you want to dumb it right down, mate, yeah, that's exactly what I..."
No, a leveling experience, I think that's called, Colin.
So, Mark, where to start? Did you always aspire? Was CEO the goal? You know, when you think back and you started your career, was that the plan?
Not as specific as that. I think my ambition, which I've always talked to my kids about as well, is to make the most of the ability that I had, right? So it was this rather ill-defined sort of idea that I didn't want to finish my working life feeling like I could have done something more, or I could have worked at a higher level. And, you know, I think the CEO ambition actually sort of emerged through my career when I sort of got to the point where I thought, you know, I'm pretty sure I can do this. And, you know, that became I guess, a more passionate pursuit in the last sort of 15 or 20 years.
Hmm. And did you go to university, Mark? How did kind of that transition into business work for you?
Oh, so I've got a particularly boring past here, Colin. So, you know, I'm your classic, you know, shiny-assed accountant. I studied accounting at university. And you know, my career, you know, in the last 20 years has mainly been in healthcare, but the first 20 years was all in resources, right? Oh. So I started working with BHP originally. And, you know, those big organizations are great sort of starting points, right, because they put a lot into their grad programs and stuff like that, but I only lasted there about 4 or 5 years. So now it was to sort of do accounting, straight out of accounting into the BHP grad program and moved on from there. As I say, I spent the first 20 years in resources, in diamonds and gold after that, which was just the most fascinating of businesses to work in, and then ended up in healthcare when the company I was working for got taken over.
Yeah, so it's worth for our non-Australian listeners. So BHP is mining and resources, so diamonds and gold. Yeah, that'd be interesting, Mark.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, the diamonds and gold was at a company called Ashton Mining that owned about half of the Argyle Diamond Mine, which is the large diamond mine in the northwest part of Australia. And I actually got involved there, through people giving me great opportunities, which is another sort of lesson that's always stuck with me as someone who leads people. You know, you need to give good people the chance sometimes to do things that their direct experience mightn't necessarily say they can do. But I went in there off the back of my finance background, but ended up looking after diamond marketing. And this was the time when De Beers was very active in the diamond market. People forget about De Beers, but, you know, for 100 years they were diamonds, you know, the Oppenheimer family, Anglo-American, right, all that sort of stuff, right? Really fascinating organizations, but, you know, great lessons out of it. You know, when you're negotiating with someone like that who doesn't think you have a real alternative to not dealing with them, you know, the fabulous lessons that I've used in a lot of places later in my career.
Yeah, so some of those really key kind of managerial skills, which are so important for culture, right? Things like negotiation, courageous conversations, expectation setting. Did you have someone that was really an influence on you at the start of your career, Mark, or was it really a case of just picking up what you could learn as you went along?
I think it's more the latter. I've worked for some good people along the way. I think going back to my earlier comment, the thing I'm most grateful for is two or three key people being willing to give me the opportunity to do things that, as I say, my experience at the time wouldn't have said that I was a natural fit for. Right. And that created a lot of opportunities for me and helped me build my experience. But I've never had a mentor. Even though I've mentored a lot of people, I've never felt the need for that. So I've just picked up bits and pieces along the way. I do think, as a general rule, I know this would be your view, is that we prepare people for senior management quite poorly, at least in the Australian context. I suspect it's worldwide, right? You know, we think because someone's mowed the lawn straight for 5 years, we can put them in charge of brain surgery, right? And it doesn't work like that. I mean, you know, leadership, I've always thought, is partly innate and partly learned, like most of those sort of softer skills. And so you need to put time and effort into people on a day-to-day basis as much as the sort of structured learning, so that they're better prepared to take on those roles where, as we all know, it's less about the technical skills you bring and more about the people management skills. You know, exactly as you were alluding to before, it's the influencing, it's the empathy, it's the negotiation. And that doesn't come naturally for everyone, but it's absolutely critical if you're going to be an effective leader and try and build an effective culture.
Yeah, and I completely we don't prepare people for management. You know, I still see the fact that we promote people based on length of tenure. You've been here 5 years, it's your turn. Technical expertise, you've got all of these smarts, or they just don't know what to do with them within the pay band. I had a friend once, and I hadn't seen him for a few months, and I was just joking about some of this stuff. I said, I'm woe betide to get made head of special projects. It's like, because at that stage, I've got no idea what to do with you, and he'd just been made head of special projects.
Oh, no, that's the one step from the door, I think.
So accountant, obviously, you mentioned, I think, that the business got taken over. It's certainly in the time that I've known you, although I haven't known you since then. So you went to Sigma Pharmaceuticals. I think that was early 2000s, Mark, was it?
Yeah. So I started with BHP. I was there about 5 years. Then I had 15 years with a company called Ashton Mining, which, as I say, owned this interest in the Argyle diamond mine. Also had diamond mines in, in Indonesia, Angola. Angola was absolutely fascinating because we were still in civil war at the time. And, I can remember going through customs and being escorted by two guys with AK-47s out the doors. You know, sort of gives you a good reminder of where you actually are. But It got taken over by Rio Tinto. And Rio Tinto was keen for me to stay because they were our partner in the Argyle project. But, you know, from a personal perspective, I thought, well, I don't want to be a medium-sized fish in a ginormous pond, right? I actually want to be somewhere I can make a difference. Also didn't want to stay in mining, not because I didn't enjoy mining. I think it's a really fabulous industry to be involved in. But, you know, healthcare looked like one of those areas. I thought, you can see an aging population coming. So this is around 2000, and I thought, if I try and make the move into healthcare, it's a growing industry, but it also proves I can take the skills I've got and transport them into a completely different place. It's always been interesting for me to reflect on the different lessons I've learned out of different businesses in that context. Like mining, and it's an overgeneralized statement, right? Mining is really good at managing big projects because, you know, that's what it's all about. You know, once you've taken the top off the pit, well, what you do after that doesn't matter because you've already sunk all the big money to get to that point, right? Whereas companies like Sigma, which was a large pharmaceutical wholesaler, you know, $4 billion of revenue at 2% EBITDA margins, they get super efficient at the process piece, right? Absolutely hopeless at managing big projects. But the process piece is managed within the inch of its life because if you don't, you don't make any money. So trying to, you know, going back to the question before, it's trying to layer up your experience and say, well, how do I pick the best out of both of those worlds? How do I make sure that I bring discipline to the bigger projects that need discipline, but I also apply that same approach to getting process right so that I've got an efficient business in terms of the ongoing activity.
And so when you joined Sigma, you're chief financial officer, I think, in those early 2000s. Was that your first, what we would call, C-suite role?
I'd had the CFO role at Ashton before it was taken over. When I look back, you know, I still had the training wheels on. You know, I thought I was pretty good at the time, but it was still early days in that C-suite journey, and and understanding what it is to be a leader in the business. I think, you know, that's a lifelong journey in some respects. But, you know, I think I was still probably learning that piece when I took that job on.
Mm. Did you feel a different level of responsibility in that first C-suite role? When you think back, did you know, and I talk often the fact that C-suite are the role models for the culture that they expect within the organization. You still need that next tier down of managers to make sure that it's practiced day to day. Did you feel that heightened sense, or was the training wheel still on and you were still kind of
figuring it out? No, I mean, that would be one of the areas where I don't think I necessarily fully appreciated my role as part of a senior management team to demonstrate. Mm. It's not that I felt like I demonstrated bad behaviours, but it wasn't as conscious that I needed, you know, that it, being in that C-suite role, it was a greater level of visibility. And I think, you know, one of the things I learned during that time was just the greater impact of your behaviours when you're in those roles. So I didn't realise it when I went into the role, but I think I certainly by the end of it, I had a really heightened sense that when you're in a senior management role, little bits of your behaviour have a disproportionate impact on people. Mm-hmm. So if you're having a bad day because of something happening at home, but you don't articulate why you're having a bad day, everyone around you assumes there's something bad happening inside the business, right? Because the body language is bad, yeah. Right? So it made me think more about being conscious of all aspects of my behaviour. I think from a general leadership perspective, I've always had this sense of you know, being responsible for my team and my team's role in the organisation. The big switch from the accountability and I guess in line with the original question came when I took on the CEO role at Sigma, which is about five. You know, I've always had this sort of custodian view of the CEO role. It is different, right? When you're in a senior management role, yes, you're in an important job, but when you're in the big chair, right? You know, you're the guy leading the organization. You're the one that sort of sets most of the strategic direction. And I think you've got an obligation to sort of look after the organization, look after the employees, look after the customers in a way that means when you go, you leave it in a better place than you found it. Mm. It sounds a bit quaint, but I never had that sort of sense in any of the C-suite roles I had. It was more about doing my job efficiently. It wasn't until I got in the CEO chair that real sense of, okay, well, this is something that I have to look after.
Now, because you'd done the CFO role, you went away for a couple of years, I think, with Symbian. Then you came back to take the CEO role at Sigma. So you probably understood the business. How long did it take you to really get a sense of everything that was going on? Because I think you're absolutely right. You get a completely different view, a completely different lens, you know. And how long did it take you to kind of like, well, I just need to figure out what's going on before I can exact any change?
It's interesting, right? I mean, it was almost the perfect scenario. So I'd left Sigma as CFO in early 2006, and the business was really was traveling really strongly, right? The share price had gone from about $1.50 to $15 over that time. And they'd done a 5-for-1 share split, so I was back at about $3. But it was really going well, right? And the reason I left was because it was at that point I was sort of starting to look for CEO roles and I wasn't going to get the chance there. Well, in the 4 or 5 years I was away for a raft of reasons, you know, the business actually went through an incredibly tough time. So by the time I got back, the share price had gone from $3 to 30 cents.
Wow.
They owed about $1 billion to the banks and were in default. Remember, this was sort of right about the time of the GFC. The CEO and CFO had been charged with accounting fraud and misleading and deceptive conduct. They had a class action on their hands, and their biggest customer, which was Pfizer, which was about 15% of their sales, had just told them that they were moving away. Right. So they finished up the old CEO and they reached out to me to take on the role. And, you know, by that stage, I'd sort of been battling away for 4 or 5 years. Because, I mean, the problem when you're hunting out a sort of CEO gig, right, is if you haven't been one, it's almost, you know, and I think it actually applies to any level of more senior role you're chasing. I can remember when I was trying to chase CFO roles, right? People would say, well, you haven't been one before. And it was incredibly frustrating because I'd say, well, you know, where do you think the CEOs of 20 years' time are coming from?
So that's right.
So, you know, I'd been out of the business for 4 or 5 years. I mean, it had completely gone to the shit. That's the neatest summary I can give you.
Yeah.
And they came and approached me and I thought, you know, unless there's something fundamentally changed here, this is just a good business that's been run badly. And I reckon I can get in there and fix it up, notwithstanding all of those things I just described. Mm. I think I've relayed this story to you before, Colin. I thought, well, if I fix it, I'm a legend. If it goes to hell, I'll blame previous management, right? But going back to your original, I could have told you 2 weeks after I was in what was wrong.
Right.
Right. I think, you know, another thing I've learned over the years is the things that make businesses go bad are very rarely complex. They might be complex to fix, but the things that actually make them go bad, it's really basic stuff. Mm-hmm. No clearly articulated strategy, you know, you're not looking after your people, poor execution, right? So I could have told you 2 weeks after I got into the chair what the problem was, but it took me another 2-3 years to actually fix it. And it's always a, you know, I always try and keep that sort of lesson in my mind that just understanding what wrong is wrong and fixing it. They're two different concepts because inevitably, you know, the culture piece becomes part of that fix, and culture doesn't fix itself quickly. So it was an enormously rewarding job to make people proud to work for that business again, because, you know, Sigma then went through a journey over the following 4 or 5 years where the share price again sort of went up 4 or 5-fold, earnings doubled, you know, and seeing people energized and proud to be part of that, you know, well, it's a great old Australian business, was incredibly rewarding. And so it's probably the most rewarding thing I've had happen as a CEO, because it's sort of like you've led the business to that point. But just seeing people happy and proud to work for the business again was fantastic.
Which is what it's about, right? You know, the culture piece, at its base level, you know, someone said to me once, is like, how do I know if I've got a good culture? It's like, people are happy. And you don't have to ask them to go the extra mile when it's required. They just do it because they're happy to do so. And you know, Mark, this is something that you understand, is this link between strategy and culture. And another question I always get asked, what comes first? And it's that classic Peter Drucker quote about culture eating strategy for breakfast. The reality is you've kind of got to do both continuously.
Yeah.
You've got to have a good start point for strategy, but then it's got to be flexible enough to be able to respond to whatever the market's looking for. But you've also got to continuously build a culture, which is where we have these, I guess we call them transformation programs, which just tweak the culture. Now that, you know, I first worked with you in 2015. And I know you still credit my success is down to you. So I just want to go on record as saying thank you. For anyone who's listening,
I'm glad you finally called it out.
Mark Hooper and Jackie Pearson, thank you so much. But at that time, one of the things that you were doing through projects and other mechanisms was just to tweak the culture, just to keep elevating it. I would come back and do these monthly sessions. And you were present at all of those. And I often hold that up as an example of a CEO that's invested not only in making sure strategically we're on the right path, but actually we're incrementally improving the culture as we go, right?
In all of my senior roles, but particularly in my CEO role, my guiding light has always been, what would I expect if I was someone inside the business, right? So when we got you in to do those culture sessions, it was very simple for me, right? If I was someone inside that business and I wanted to understand whether the CEO was actually taking this seriously, I would see him or her there, right? So it's as simple as that. So, you know, I think the golden rule in terms of culture, you know, treat people how you'd like to be treated, you know, it's dead easy from that perspective. I mean, it doesn't always play out as quietly as neatly in practice. But, you know, so all of those sorts of things that, you know, we did during that time, I didn't have to think about them. It was just sort of, well, what would I expect? And therefore, I need to model that behavior. I think the disappointing part for me was I didn't always see that across the entire senior leadership team, right, despite my best efforts.
Yeah.
And it eats away, right? You know, when you don't have alignment, particularly across your senior management team, it eats away at the culture quite quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And I think it was one of the conversations we had, is because we had three members of the senior management team used to sit in the front row. We used to fill out for people trying to paint a picture. It was the canteen. There was about 100 people in there for each session. And we had three members of the senior management team who would sit on the front row every single session. Yeah. And there was one or two routinely not attend. And you would be like, are they in the room? Where are they? Because we know that your culture is only as strong as your weakest point.
100%.
And if we haven't got that commitment, then that's the bit that, you know, could eat away at the culture, right?
And, you know, and we've all seen it, right? You get little bits of sort of passive aggressive behavior. So they don't come out and say, no, I'm not coming.
Yeah.
I would support you. They just don't do it. It annoys the crap out of me. It's just because it's so unnecessary. And, you know, I mean, I'm a big believer in this stuff, so I was happy to do it. But, you know, I'd like to think even if I didn't believe it, I would at least be, you know, emotionally aware enough to say, I don't want to do this, but I still need to show the team that I'm committed to this.
Yeah.
And there's sometimes things you do as CEO or other C-suite execs that maybe don't sort of thrill you with joy, but, you know, it's part of the leadership pace, right? It comes back to modeling a set of behaviors that you expect out of the organization. And the comment you make about it stopping at the most, it stops at the most senior level, it doesn't support it. Because once people see that the person they're reporting to doesn't support a particular cultural initiative or an element of culture that is in the rest, everyone opts out, right? And it's, you know, I can think of no more frustrating experience for someone, you know, in the business who hears the CEO talk about aspirationally what they're trying to do from a cultural perspective, and their day-to-day experience is the exact opposite. And that the reason that happens is because the layers of management charged with making sure the consistency of culture is, they just don't do it, right? And, you know, I've always called that the blancmange layer, you know, the layer that absorbs energy down, but it also absorbs energy up, right? You know, I can remember at times these same people, I think, were also responsible for where team members were trying to get issues elevated and they would sort of stop it becoming something that got a broader audience, which is, again, incredibly frustrating for those people and pretty unproductive. But every organization has the blancmange layer, right? And it generally sits at a GM or just below, but it's the level that stops the implementation of what you're trying to do from a cultural and practical perspective. And you need to try and pick where it is and to the extent you can fix it. But it's hard, Colin, as you know.
Yeah, it is, Mark. And that's the layer often that I end up with. You know, people will say, oh, you're working with leadership teams on culture. It's like, for me, the leadership teams often get it and they understand it. Yeah. The employees want to see something different. And where I operate is that tier of people where the expectation is that they understand culture, but they don't. The expectation is they've got all of the people skills to create a great place to work. They don't. And when you're absolutely right. I can go in and I could work with people for 2 days, but they've got to make the decision to do something different.
Yep.
70% will, 30% won't. And it's how do we kind of take those 30% on that journey? Now, I've got a question for you, Mark, that I've never asked anyone on the podcast before, because I won't go into all of the details, there's no need. But there was a situation when you were CEO at Sigma, you made a decision and it made the news, right? And there was Mark Hooper being interviewed as part of the news because of this decision. What was it like being on the news, with this big decision that you'd made?
So the one you're referring to is obviously letting the Chemist Warehouse business.
That's right, the Chemist Warehouse. Yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, eventually meant I had to sort of rebuild the business a second time. It was a pretty tough time, I have to say. Like, so just to contextualize it for people, when I was in Sigma, of the $4 billion of revenue, Chemist Warehouse would have been around half of that. It's a volume business, right? So it underwrote the economics a lot of what we're doing. These guys were pretty tough negotiators, right? Where I drew on my De Beers experience, right, to be honest, where you're negotiating with someone who really doesn't think you've got a different alternative, you know? So I went through a few negotiations with these guys. This was the third contract I negotiated with them, and we couldn't reach agreement. It was really tough, right? Because I guess my attitude was, if I can't get a set of commercial arrangements where I make money, why have I got them, right? I end up keeping them because I'm just scared of not having them, right? And that just doesn't feel like, from a strategic or economic perspective, to make any sense. But I knew if they didn't renew the contract, I was going to sack about 500 people, you know, because we were publicly listed. Public markets deal very poorly with that sort of news, right? And I can remember saying to the board at the time, well, the market's going to hate this. You know, the share price is going to get smashed, but you can't sign an uneconomic contract because you're just scared of the alternative. Like, you got to sort of be willing to sort of back yourself. And to be fair, the Sigma board was terrific, right? They gave me a lot of support. That first 6-12, that was really tough, right? Now, as it turns out, they had given about half the business to DHL, who made a bit of a mess of it, and they came and gave it back to us. So we ended up getting it back on terms that were acceptable. So which vindicated, I guess, the original rationale for the decision. But it was a really interesting time from a career perspective. So everyone said, well, there you go. That proved you were right, right? But if it had all gone to shit,
yeah,
right, and I hadn't been able to fix it, everyone would have been saying, well, that was obvious, that was never going to work, mate. Even though, you know, every part of me felt like it was a rational decision from an economic perspective, and I was genuinely trying to do what I thought was in the best interests of long-term shareholders, and I held quite a bit of Sigma shares myself, so I felt mm-hmm. like I was co-invested with the rest of the market. But, you know, it was a pretty tough journey there for 3 or 4 years. So by the time I finished up at Sigma, I had made my mind up at the time that I needed to stay, because I probably would have left after I'd been there for about 5 or 6 years if we hadn't lost that contract. Because I think CEOs hang around for too long. You get a bit myopic about what works and what doesn't, because by the time you've been there for 5, 6, 7 years, unless something fundamentally changed in the business, right? You think you've got it working pretty well. Well, you would. You've set most of it up, right? You lose a bit of your objectivity. So, but when we made this decision to let that contract go, I thought, well, that was my call. I need, you know, that sense of, it goes back to that sense of custodianship. I need to leave this business in better. I can't just make this call, walk out the door and say, good luck with whatever's left there. So I hung around for another 4 or 5 years to get the business back to the point where it was making as much money as if we'd accepted the original contract, but under a revised business model, which is where we got to. But
yeah.
I was completely worn out by the time I got there, and now they've gone and subsequently taken them back. So it's kind of full circle. So really tested my emotional resilience, I think. Mm-hmm. And you know, when I first got into Sigma, you know, I described it earlier, it was in a pretty bad place. And when we lost the contract, it was in a pretty bad place. I've always felt the crazier and more difficult the circumstances get, the calmer you need to look as a leader. Not in a bullshitty way. So don't try and tell people that there aren't problems that they can obviously see, but give them a sense that what you can do here is manage your way out of this situation in a sensible way over time that doesn't have everyone running around with their hair on fire, right? Because if the CEO looks like they're panicked and you know, stressed, then the rest of the organization feels that tenfold. So it takes a lot of resilience to be able to deliver that in an authentic way, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, that's the other thing I'm big on. You know, it's too hard to be a leader if you're not authentic to the person you are, right? It's because it's an act you're putting on.
That's right.
Right? So, and that's different. That's different for everyone, right? An authentic leader is by definition a different version of for every individual. But you know, being able to find a way where I could continue to be authentic to what I thought was really happening in the business, but give people a sense of control. And as much as anything else, trust me as a leader. You know, that cornerstone of leadership is trust, right? If people don't trust you, they won't follow you, right? So I had to be very conscious about all of those things, but maintaining trust from the business and from shareholders and the board that we could work our way through this, which was enormously challenging over an extended period.
Mm. Well, by the time this is published, probably about 18 months or so at Paragon, and we worked together fairly recently before we recorded it, and the energy's back, the spark is back. Tell us a little bit about Paragon and kind of what's that plan for the next, I don't know, 6-12 months more.
So Paragon is a company that, you know, at its most basic represents overseas companies in the Asia-Pac region selling medical equipment and all forms of medical equipment. So all the way through from cyclotrons down to basic sort of labs, microscopes in a lab and all of the consumables that go with that. And we also provide all the service and maintenance piece. Now, we have a bit of manufacturing as well, but, I mean, that's the guts of the business. But it's a healthcare roll-up. So it's the result of about 25 or 30 businesses being purchased and rolled together over the last 15 years. And it had had quite a few challenges, I think, in terms of integrating those businesses. I mean, there's not many roll-ups that work well. If you around the world, they are hard to do well. So when I finished at Sigma, Paragon approached me to take on the CEO role here. And it just looked like an interesting challenge, to be honest, Colin. Like it was a little of the same thematic from when I took the job at Sigma. I thought, here's a good business that I think actually that should be doing better. And I guess all of the lessons that I'd had from my time at Sigma and other places, you know, and the fact that it was publicly listed, which has obviously played to an area where I had plenty of experience. So yeah, I took it on 18 months ago. And again, I could have told you 2 weeks after I was in what the issues were, right? You know, that sounds more arrogant than I mean it to, but I guess, you know, when you've been working for long enough, you can see things pretty, you can see things pretty quickly. And again, it's not the complex stuff that goes wrong. So there's plenty of challenges inside the business, but I think there's an enormous amount of upside. So I spent the last 12 months, I guess, trying to put in place just the basic building blocks, again, of what I think the business has sort of been missing. So I've done quite a bit of work around strategy. And, you know, just in the last sort of 6 months, we started to ramp up the work around culture, right, which is why we've got you involved to help us out, right? And, you know, as you and I have talked about, I've actually got a very engaged group of people for the most part. They just need a bit more direction to that energy. So, you know, I feel like I've got a pretty good base to work with, but, you know, this is as I say, it's a healthcare business where the underlying fundamentals mean that we should be having reasonably strong organic growth. We've got some quite bold ambitions for the business. We've now done some strategic planning to sort of flesh that out in a bit more meaningful way as to how that's going to happen. So we're sort of on the cultural part of the journey now, you know, both from a general perspective, but also a much greater focus on, you know, turning good ideas into good outcomes, which is where most organizations fail, right? You know, it's that execution piece, and that has a heavy base in culture.
Mm. Mark, I've got one last question before I let you get on with your actual day job. So it's interesting you mentioned you never had a mentor. No, I've never had a mentor either. You know, there's a lot of people who come in and out of my lives and people whose opinions that I've sought. But I largely educated myself and continue to educate myself. Not that I think I've got all of the answers, absolutely not. So kind of what do you do to relax? What do you do to kind of educate yourself? You know, what does that pathway look like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm exactly the same, right? It sounds particularly arrogant, don't you think? That we're so good, we don't
need mentors.
I've met people who are passionate about mentors and what they can bring. I mean, I work with a few people who consider me mentor. I just think I'm having a chat to them about stuff, right? But I've never felt the need for it. I'd like to think I've always tried to keep learning because I think that is quite important. I'm quite selective about what I try and pick up. I mean, I saw you posted something the other week about, you know, sometimes people's simplistic approach of attaching themselves to lists, right? Drives me absolutely insane, right? if it was that, there was a great quote in your article, I think, about, well, you know, you don't see really great leaders sitting down with their list each day to tick off what they're
doing. That's right, yeah.
100% correct. But there are, I don't read books. You keep sending them to me.
I know. You never read them. They always get sent back to me.
So I share them around the organization. I do selectively scan stuff and quite deliberately. So I think you're just looking for those little pearls every now and again that make you think about things slightly differently. There's a very short article that I read about 20 years ago that I still cart around with me today. And it's an article, the heading is, "Your job's only as good as your boss," right? And it's a three-paragraph article that says, you know, the most important thing to select when you're picking a job, apart from the sort of, you know, whether you'll be challenged by it, is who you're working for. And we don't always get to choose that,
right? That's right, yeah.
But it just, it really resonated with me, this idea that the people we work for are the main determinants of the environment in which we have to operate, and they can largely create or hinder our success. And it's more been a personal reflection for me to say, like I said, that's the role I play with people. You know, I help or hinder my team being able to do the job that they do. So I try and look for little snippets like that. I like picking up concepts from book, which I realize is not a particularly help. So I really like the idea of blue ocean thinking, right? But I've never read the blue ocean book, right? So couldn't be bothered. I love the book, and I've talked to people about this. So there's a book called The No Asshole Rule, right? Which I think is a fabulous concept, which says every business puts up with assholes that destroys culture and chews energy. And, you know, the definition of an asshole in this book is someone who every time you sit down with them for a conversation, you feel worse for the experience, Right. And everyone has your reaction, Colin, right? Because we've all had those people.
That's right.
They suck energy from you.
Yeah.
Right. So I take selective snippets rather than whole pieces, right? But I think it's good just to think and challenge yourself where you can, because, you know, it does help with your own development, hopefully makes you a better manager.
Mark, it has been fabulous talking to you on the podcast. It really has. I can't believe how quickly the time's gone. I always say that, but it's true. It's flown by. Thank you so much for being generous with your time and for sharing your story on the Culture Makers podcast.
Thanks, Colin.
Thanks so much for listening to the podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the link with your colleagues and friends or with your connections on social media. If you'd like to find out more about the work that I do, head to www.colindellis.com or find me on LinkedIn.